March 24th, 1991, Victoria, British Columbia. Four-year-old Michael Dunahy accompanies his family to a football game at a local elementary school, and after they park their car, Michael asks if he can walk to a nearby playground. Within minutes, Michael's parents notice that he is not at the playground and has vanished without a trace. Over the next two decades, there would be numerous leads, including an alleged sighting of Michael in New Jersey, the surprising discovery of his missing poster in a deceased individual's home, and a couple of young adults who were briefly suspected of being Michael himself, but no trace of him is ever found. After that, the trail went cold.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to the latest episode of The Trail Went Cold. I'm your host, Robin Warder, and today's episode is going to be a very sad one, as we will be chronicling two missing children's cases from British Columbia: the 1991 disappearance of four-year-old Michael Dunahy, as well as the 1989 disappearance of three-year-old Casey Bohun. The voice you just heard narrate our intro was a listener named Julie, the winner of The Trail Went Cold's most recent listener voiceover contest. And she did an amazing job, so thank you very much, Julie. A number of listeners have already entered this contest since it was implemented last year, and if you would like to enter and haven't done so already, I will provide instructions at the end of this episode. Anyway, Julie specifically requested that I cover the disappearance of Michael Dunahy on the podcast, as her own father is actually a retired officer from the Royal Canadian Mounted Police who worked on this case. As you might know, The Trail Went Cold is a Canadian-produced podcast, and Michael's disappearance is one of our country's most famous unsolved cold cases. I've been wanting to cover it for a while, but one of the biggest obstacles is that there is so little evidence to work with. Michael went missing during a very narrow window of time, and it's pretty obvious he was abducted by an unknown perpetrator. Since the only unanswered question is who was actually responsible, it's not like I can spend too much time exploring potential theories. So that's why I've decided to combine Michael's case with the disappearance of Casey Bohun, another British Columbia child who went missing 19 months beforehand and over 100 kilometers from where Michael disappeared. Her case did not get nearly as much coverage as Michael's did, though Casey's name did pop up in the news again in 2013 when her sister wound up at the center of a completely unrelated story which made headlines. Even though their disappearances are unlikely to be connected, both Michael and Casey were victims of horrible tragedies which deserve resolution. I'll start off by exploring Michael's case before I move on to Casey's, and then I'll share my thoughts on both of them. However, before we get started, just a quick reminder that The Trail Went Cold is a weekly podcast which is currently available for download on several platforms, including iTunes, Stitcher, and Google Play Music. So if you like this podcast, be sure to subscribe to it, and please leave us a rating or review on any of those sites to help spread the word and garner us more exposure. The Trail Went Cold is on Patreon, so if you would like to learn how to support the show, please visit our page at patreon.com/thetrailwentcold. For as little as $1 a month, you can garner access to exclusive rewards, which may include stickers and thank you cards, early access to episodes, and bonus content. So with all that out of the way, let us now start off by exploring the disappearance of Michael Dunahy. Our story begins in Victoria, British Columbia, Canada in 1991. Our central figure is four-year-old Michael Dunahy, who lives with his parents, Bruce and Crystal Dunahy, and his six-month-old baby sister, Caitlin. At around 12:30 p.m. on Sunday, March 24th, Michael accompanied his family to Blanchard Elementary School. There was a touch football tournament taking place there, and his mother was going to be playing in one of the games. After they parked their car, Michael asked his parents if he could go to a nearby playground, which was adjacent to the parking lot. Even though the playground would be visible from the football field where her game was taking place, Crystal would recall that she had what she described as quote-unquote tummy butterflies and a motherly instinct that something wasn't quite right. But in spite of this, she told Michael he could walk over to the playground, but to stay put there until his father went to get him. After Michael left, Crystal and Bruce spent the next few minutes putting Caitlin into her stroller and taking her and their gear over to the football field. After they settled in, Bruce climbed on top of a rock to look over at the playground, but to his horror, he discovered that Michael was not there. Bruce went looking for Michael, but could not find him, and it wasn't long before the football games at the school came to a halt, and over 50 people started performing a search for him. However, there was no sign of Michael anywhere, so his parents notified the police and reported him missing. At the time he was last seen, Michael was dressed in a blue hooded jacket, a Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles t-shirt, rugby pants, and blue sneakers. Since he vanished during a very narrow time frame, police did not believe Michael simply wandered off and instantly classified his disappearance as an abduction. In fact, they suspected that Michael might have been abducted while he was crossing the parking lot and never even made it to the playground. The search for Michael would eventually grow into what became the largest missing persons investigation in the history of Canada at that point. Every single police detective in Victoria was called in to participate in the search for him. The Victoria Police Department went all out with investigating potential leads, interviewing all known sex offenders in Victoria, and pretty much everyone who was believed to be in the area at the time Michael went missing. As with most missing children's cases, Michael's disappearance sent shockwaves throughout his community. Until it occurred, residents of Victoria never expected something like that could happen in their city. It would be described as their quote-unquote JFK moment, as everyone from Victoria would remember where they were on the day Michael went missing. The boy had seemingly vanished into thin air, and with virtually no evidence to work with, investigators hoped to jog witnesses' memories by reconvening everyone who had a car in the school parking lot that day to see if they remembered anything unusual. One detail which seemed to stand out was a brown or dark-colored van which was parked in the middle of the lot halfway between the playground and the spot where the Dunhees parked. While numerous witnesses recalled seeing the vehicle there, nobody actually saw it arrive or leave, and it seemed to disappear from the lot around the same time Michael went missing. If their memories were accurate, Michael would have passed by this van while walking towards the playground. No one could provide any specific details about the van for a positive identification, but many brown vans in the area were tracked down and investigated. Their owners were questioned by police, but they would be ruled out as suspects, and it could never be conclusively established if this van had any connection with Michael's disappearance. Over the next few years, Michael's case would be featured on the TV program America's Most Wanted multiple times. They first broadcast a report about his disappearance on April 5th, less than 2 weeks after he went missing, and it would generate a surprising viewer tip from the other side of the continent. The day before the broadcast, a witness named Harold Krusch claimed that he had been frequenting a convenience store in Maple Shade, New Jersey, when he was approached by a young boy. According to Krusch, the boy spoke in what sounded like a Canadian accent and said, quote, "Hello, my name is Michael Dunahy. I am from Victoria, Canada. I'm trying to get back to my mummy and daddy. Please help me," end quote. Krusch then said a little brown-haired girl entered the store and specifically referred to the boy as Michael Dunahy before a black man with a pockmarked face came inside and left with both children. When Krusch watched America's Most Wanted the following evening and saw a photo of Michael, he recognized him as the boy he had seen in the store and contacted the police. However, Krusch's statements about the incident kept changing, so investigators eventually became very skeptical that he had actually seen Michael. But there would be another reported sighting in New Jersey. On June 19th, an 8-year-old girl and boy were approached in the Berlin borough of Camden County by a black man driving a Camaro who offered them candy and a ride. When the girl refused, the driver grabbed her arm, but both kids broke free and managed to get away. According to the two kids, there was another man in the passenger seat, and both a young girl and a young boy who was crying were in the back seat. The children were shown a photo of Michael Dunahy and said the boy in the car looked like him. When the girl was shown a composite sketch of the unidentified black male allegedly seen with Michael at the convenience store in Maple Shade, she thought he looked like the driver of the Camaro. But much like the other sighting of Michael in New Jersey, this lead never went anywhere. Since Michael's disappearance got such extensive media coverage throughout North America, there would be a number of reported sightings of him, not just in Canada, but in the US as well. During the first year Michael was missing, police received an estimated total of around 12,000 tips and 789 possible sightings. Back in 1991, all these tips would have to be written down on carbon paper, put into an inbox, and sorted manually by hand. Sadly, the Dunahy family would also be the victim of cruel pranks, as they received no less than 5 calls from the same individual who reported that Michael had been murdered as a sacrifice to the devil. There was one caller who even demanded a $10,000 ransom for Michael's return. In addition to the case being featured on America's Most Wanted, Crystal Dunahy also made an appearance on Geraldo Rivera's talk show alongside John Walsh. And yes, sadly, the notorious fraudulent so-called psychic, Sylvia Brown, she even spoke to the Dunahy family and told them that Michael was alive and living in Torrance, California, and would return within 18 months. Not surprisingly, this did not come to fruition. As the years went on, a new reward of $100,000 would be offered for information, and there would eventually be multiple occurrences of investigators looking into young men who were believed to potentially be Michael himself. In 2011, residents of the village of Chase, British Columbia, pointed police towards a young resident who many people thought resembled a grown-up Michael Dunahy, but DNA proved it wasn't him. 2 years later, investigators looked into a 26-year-old man from Surrey who often posted in a forum for the Vancouver Canucks hockey team and bore a resemblance to the age-enhanced composite sketch of Michael. According to the young man, he had no memory of anything before the first grade, but remembered moving around a lot as a child. By this point, he had been abandoned by his father, and his mother was deceased, but once again, DNA testing ruled out the possibility of him being Michael. A very unexpected development would also take place in Milwaukee in 2009. A 62-year-old resident named Vernon Seitz had recently confessed to his psychiatrist that back in 1959, when he was only 12 years old, he had been abducted and sexually assaulted by unknown individuals. They then forced him to shoot and kill a 14-year-old boy, and he also saw his abductors fatally shoot another boy. Seitz asked his psychiatrist to contact the police in order to arrange a meeting so he could make the same confession to them, but when police raided his home, they discovered that Seitz had died of natural causes. It would turn out that he had a large amount of child pornography in his basement, along with disturbing drawings of young boys being tortured, and files on unsolved missing children's cases from the 1980s and 90s. He also had a missing poster of Michael Dunahy, along with a map for a location titled Millstream Park. Well, there was no such place in Milwaukee, but there was a location northwest of Victoria named Millstream Road, which led to several remote parks. Seitz also had many materials related to another case involving a missing boy, the disappearance of 11-year-old Jacob Wetterling, who was abducted in Minnesota in 1989. It would turn out that shortly after Jacob's disappearance, Seitz had visited Jacob's mother on at least 2 occasions, claiming to be a psychic, and providing her with a painting he made of Jacob. Seitz apparently had a habit of contacting families of missing children and offering his services as a psychic, and while the Dunahy family thought he seemed familiar, they could not recall if Seitz ever contacted them. Well, of course, Jacob Wetterling's remains were finally found in 2016, and it turned out he was abducted and murdered by a man named Danny Heinrich, and that Seitz had no involvement. Nothing has ever linked Seitz to Michael's disappearance, and no conclusive evidence has ever been uncovered that Seitz murdered anyone. Anyway, Bruce and Crystal Dunahy have never given up hope that they will find out what happened to their son someday, and that he might even still be alive somewhere. Crystal has become a major advocate for missing children's cases, as she served as president of the organization Child Find British Columbia, and has been awarded the Order of British Columbia for her work. Crystal received a lot of credit for helping to implement the Amber Alert system in British Columbia, as she always believed that Michael would have been found if the Amber Alert system had existed back in 1991. Victoria and its surrounding communities often hold yearly charity events to raise money for Child Find. These include the Michael Dunahy Slow Pitch Tournament of Hope and the Michael Dunahy Keep the Hope Alive 5K Fun Run, and Michael's now grown-up sister, Caitlin, has played a role in organizing these events. In 2012, author Valerie Green published a book about the case titled Vanished, The Michael Dunahy Story. At one point, Green wrote out a letter for Michael in the event that he was still alive somewhere and reading the book. The letter read, quote, "Perhaps you might recall an old favorite toy, a cereal, a crying baby who was your sister Caitlin, going with your dad to Fleming Beach to watch the fishing boats coming in and listening to your real mother telling you a bedtime story. Only your abductor or abductors know the truth about your disappearance that day, and they have kept that appalling secret for 25 years. And it is now time to break the silence. An answer is well overdue. We need to know what happened on that morning in March of 1991. End quote. But unfortunately, after all these years, there are still no solid leads on what may have happened to Michael Dunahy. So I guess you could say, the trail went cold. Anyway, let us now move on to our episode's second missing children's case. Our second story begins in the community of North Delta, British Columbia in 1989. Our central figure is 3-year-old Casey Bohun, who lives with her mother, Barbara Bohun, her 8-month-old sister, Stacy, and Barbara's current fiancé, Jonathan Poyle. They have recently moved to North Delta from Langley and have only been living in their new home for a month. The girls' biological father, Donald Bohun, is currently living in Saskatchewan. On the morning of August 5th, Barbara woke up at around 6:30 a.m. and walked into the bedroom which Casey and Stacy shared together. She claimed that Casey was still sleeping while she changed Stacy's diaper before she returned to bed. Around 3 hours later, Jonathan heard Stacy crying and went into her bedroom to grab her. He claimed that Casey was not there, but could hear the sound of the TV in the living room and assumed Casey was watching it. Jonathan then took Stacy out into the backyard, but at around 10 a.m., the family noticed that Casey wasn't anywhere in the house, so a search of the neighborhood was performed for her. Since Casey was known for being an inquisitive child who often liked to explore, her family initially looked into the possibility that she had wandered off or gotten lost, as they had just recently moved into the neighborhood and Casey did not know the area well. But when the child could not be found, she was reported missing to the police. Police dogs would track Casey's scent down the street before it came to an end at nearby Annieville Park. Even though the authorities performed an extensive search of the area, they could find no trace of Casey. A neighbor would recall seeing Casey playing on the front porch of her house at around 9:30 a.m., about a half hour before her family noticed she was missing. Casey's father, Donald Bohun, would be questioned by police, and after passing a polygraph test, he was ruled out as a suspect. Now here's the interesting part about that. Police have never named any potential suspects in Casey's disappearance, but they've also specifically stated that Donald Bohun is the only person they've ruled out as a suspect. Only a few months after Casey went missing, Barbara and Jonathan took Stacy and moved about 7 kilometers away to Surrey because they felt the family would be safer there. At the time, Barbara did not even realize she was pregnant and soon gave birth to another daughter named Shauna. On May 12, 1991, shortly after Michael Dunahy went missing, Barbara traveled to Victoria to attend a vigil commemorating what would have been Michael's 5th birthday. She told the press that she knew exactly what the Dunahys were going through and that Michael's disappearance forced her to relive the nightmare of what happened to Casey. Over the next several years, there would be many reported sightings of Casey, and the police would investigate numerous leads, but they failed to turn up any answers about what happened. Sadly, the whole ordeal seemed to have a devastating effect on Casey's family. In 2000, Stacy would be taken from her mother by social services and placed into foster care because she had started acting out and Barbara found herself unable to cope. Barbara's relationship with Jonathan also fell apart, and after he received a new job teaching English in Korea, he moved there and took Barbara's remaining daughter, Shauna, with him. This seemed to cause Barbara to reach her breaking point, and on April 29, 2001, she would commit suicide by jumping off the Patulu Bridge into the Fraser River. She did not leave behind any suicide note. When Jonathan returned for Barbara's funeral, he was interviewed by police. According to investigators, this interview raised some new questions, but Jonathan returned to Korea before he could be re-interviewed. While the search for Casey hit a dead end again, her name would appear in the news in 2013 for a very unexpected reason. Just under 3 years earlier, Tim Bachman, of the famous rock band Bachman Turner Overdrive, was charged by the Abbotsford police for the offenses of sexual interference of a person under 14, touching a young person for a sexual purpose, and sexual assault. A decade beforehand, the alleged victim had moved into Bachman's home as a foster child when she was 11 years old, and claimed that he sexually abused her over the next 3 years until she ran away. At first, the victim's name was withheld from the public, but she eventually agreed to disclose her identity, and it turned out the victim was Casey's younger sister, Stacy Bohun. At trial, Bachman was found not guilty on all counts. While the judge did not believe Stacy was deliberately dishonest and thought she came across well on the witness stand, he felt that her testimony was too unreliable and inconsistent to support a criminal conviction. By her own admission, Stacy had past issues with drugs, which affected her memory. Nonetheless, Stacy seems to be in a much healthier place today and was glad that she came forward and shared her story. 1 year later, Bachman was charged with more sexual offenses after new allegations surfaced, though these charges would later be stayed. Anyway, because Stacy Bohun was her sister, Casey's disappearance would often be mentioned in the media coverage of Bachman's trial in order to convey what a difficult childhood Stacy had. But in spite of this, there have still not been any answers about what actually happened, and Casey remains missing nearly 30 years later. So I guess you could say, the trail went cold. Now, as someone who grew up in Canada, I was 12 years old at the time Michael Dunhe went missing, and I can tell you that his story was everywhere when it happened. Even though I lived in Ontario, and Michael's disappearance took place thousands of kilometers away, I still remember often seeing his missing poster in public places. While all missing children's cases are every parent's worst nightmare, disappearances like this one are particularly devastating, as Michael's parents only let their child out of sight for a very brief window of time and then never saw him again. If you search YouTube, you'll find an old CBC news segment about this case, which aired a short time after Michael went missing, and I appreciated the fact that one of the investigators who was interviewed made it very clear that Michael's parents did nothing wrong. I've seen online discussions about this case in which commenters have been unnecessarily harsh against the Dunahees for letting Michael out of their sight for a very brief period. It's always been a pet peeve of mine when parents in missing children's cases are attacked by people who are looking at the situation from today's perspective and do not understand that the world was just a much different place back then. Michael's disappearance took place in 1991 in a relatively safe community which had never seen a child abduction like this before. Under normal circumstances, if you let your child out of sight for a brief moment in order to go to a school playground, there's probably only a 1 in a million chance they're going to get abducted by a stranger. But unfortunately for the Dunahees, this turned out to be that one. I'm sure they blamed themselves a lot and would have handled the situation differently if it took place today, but at that particular time, under those particular circumstances, they probably never thought something like this would happen. Like many parents of missing children, the Dunahees chose to keep Michael's bedroom exactly the way it was at the time he vanished, and set up a shrine with old toys and unopened birthday and Christmas gifts for him. Even after they moved to a new house, they still set up a bedroom for Michael in the exact same way. Bruce and Crystal have gone through some rough patches over the years, and the trauma has caused their fair share of blow-ups and meltdowns, but throughout it all, they've remained together. Crystal has followed the path of a number of bereaved parents by becoming a major advocate for missing children, and it's always amazing to me when parents who suffer such a horrific tragedy have the strength to use their experience to help prevent others from suffering the same thing. Now, I know that a number of the cases I've featured on this podcast have featured less than stellar police investigations, but the way the Victoria Police Department handled Michael's disappearance was about as good as it gets. They knew right from the outset that Michael had probably been abducted and wasted no time at taking action. They did everything you're supposed to do when a child turns up missing, and I believe that if they had many of today's resources and technology at their disposal back in 1991, such as the Amber Alert and video surveillance, they might have been able to solve this relatively quickly and even recover Michael safely. It's incredible to look back and see that investigators had to write down and sort all the tips they received by hand because they lacked a sophisticated computer system at that time. Unfortunately, it seems like whoever abducted Michael got extremely lucky and managed to slip through the police's fingers. Now, in case you didn't know, Victoria is located on Vancouver Island, and aside from the airports, the only access to the mainland of British Columbia or Washington State requires taking the ferry. But that doesn't necessarily mean that the person who kidnapped Michael could not have taken him off the island, as security for this type of thing was far less rigid in 1991. It should also be noted that Vancouver Island is still a pretty large place at over 32,000 square kilometers, so even if the perpetrator never left the island, there still would have been plenty of places to hide out. It sounds like the police were very thorough about canvassing the area and clearing local residents as suspects, so unless they were very good at staying off the radar and not arousing suspicion, I have my doubts that the perpetrator lived in the vicinity of a Blanchard Elementary School. The primary theory is that Michael never actually made it to the playground and was snatched as he was walking through the parking lot, possibly by the driver of the brown or dark-colored van, which was never accounted for. Given the brief window of time in which Michael's disappearance took place, and how brazen it was, it would not surprise me if the perpetrator had done something like this before. But given that this type of stranger abduction was practically unheard of in Victoria at that time, this lends credence to the idea that they did not live in the area. Of course, since this case garnered so much media coverage, both in Canada and the US, there were a ton of reported sightings of Michael, but it seems like two which really stood out were the ones that took place on the complete opposite side of the continent in New Jersey in the months following his disappearance. I've always been skeptical about the eyewitness sighting of Michael at the convenience store in Maple Shade in April, and it sounds like investigators eventually came to the same conclusion. You might think this sighting is credible because the witness, Harold Krusch, claimed the boy he saw told him he was Michael Dunahy, but his account just doesn't come across as believable to me. Here is what the boy supposedly said. Quote, "Hello, my name is Michael Dunahy. I am from Victoria, Canada. I'm trying to get back to my mommy and daddy. Please help me." End quote. I don't know about you, but to me, that just does not sound like how a 4-year-old boy would talk. It sounds a bit too articulate for someone that young. Krusch then said that a young girl came into the store and actually referred to the boy as Michael Dunahy before a black man entered and they all left together. Well, if Michael was abducted by this black man, why would he be waiting outside the store and allowing Michael to wander around inside? Forget about the fact that Michael was a missing kid. How many guardians in general are going to allow a 4-year-old to enter a convenience store and walk around by themselves? I don't know if Krusch made up this story, but he did come forward immediately after Michael's case got national coverage on America's Most Wanted, and it just doesn't ring true to me. All that being said, we did have another eyewitness sighting of Michael 2 months later in the Berlin borough of New Jersey, which is only about 15 miles away. This time, two children thought they saw Michael and an unidentified young girl in the backseat of a vehicle driven by a black man who attempted to grab them. Assuming that Harold Krusch wasn't lying about his story, there are interesting parallels between this incident and the sighting at the convenience store, as we have two young white children in the company of a suspicious black male with pockmarks on his face. But even if both these stories are true, I still have my doubts that the boy these witnesses saw was Michael, because this section of New Jersey is about as far from Victoria as you can get. The only other prominent lead in this case took place in 2009, when Michael's missing poster was found in the home of Vernon Seitz in Milwaukee after he died. Now, considering all the disturbing material involving young boys found in Seitz's possession, there's zero doubt that he was a very troubled individual. But overall, I get the impression that Seitz was just a guy who had an unhealthy obsession with missing children's cases. Judging from what he shared with his psychiatrist, it sounds like Seitz may have been the victim of some horrific abuse as a child, which left a devastating psychological effect on him, and one of the ways he may have attempted to deal with it was by inserting himself into cases involving missing boys. One of Seitz's relatives was quoted as saying, "He was not an abductor. He was a person that counseled families who had children that were abducted, and helped families find closure." Well, that statement is quite a stretch, as I don't think Seitz really helped anyone, and since he had child pornography in his possession, there really isn't any reason to defend him. It seems like Seitz had a particular obsession with Jacob Wetterling's disappearance, even going so far as to hang a laminated missing poster of Jacob in the barbershop he owned, and since that case was still unsolved at the time Seitz died, I could see how this might raise some red flags. However, Jacob's remains were finally found 2 years ago, and we now know that Seitz had no involvement with what happened to him. You could almost consider Michael Dunhee's disappearance to be the Canadian equivalent of the Jacob Wetterling case, and since these were both high-profile cases involving missing boys, I could see why Seitz might have also developed an obsession with Michael. I know that Seitz had a map from Millstream Park in his possession, a location which would have been in close proximity to Victoria, but the possible explanation for this is that Seitz may have been attempting to do his own sleuthing on Michael's case. He could have studied the area surrounding Victoria and deduced that this particular location was a spot where Michael's abductor could have gotten rid of his body, but it was all just speculation on Seitz's part. Given that Milwaukee is over 3,000 kilometers away from Vancouver Island, unless there's some sort of evidence which places Seitz in Victoria in March of 1991, I'm inclined to think he wasn't involved in Michael's disappearance, and that this whole episode is nothing more than a red herring. So in regards to tracking down Michael's actual abductor, there unfortunately just isn't that much to go on, aside from vague eyewitness descriptions of a dark-colored van which may or may not have a connection to the case. Anyway, before I wrap up Michael's story, let's now talk about the disappearance of Casey Bohun, as there seem to be more unanswered questions in this case. Like I mentioned earlier, Casey's disappearance did not get nearly as much coverage as Michael's did, and while the Dunhee family have somehow been able to keep everything together following their tragedy, Barbara Bohun's life just seemed to go into a complete downward spiral until she eventually decided to commit suicide. Now, if you search Casey Bohun's name online, you'll see that she has her own page at the Unidentified Wiki, and it contains some additional information which I did not mention here, since I could not find any legitimate sources which verified it. But the page does say that there were always rumors circulating around town about Casey's disappearance and that her mother had a difficult time dealing with it. Well, police never named anyone as a suspect in this case. They did state that the only person they eliminated as a suspect was Casey's biological father, who was living in another province at the time. So you could interpret that in a number of different ways, and infer that law enforcement did not completely discount the possibility that someone from inside Casey's home was responsible for her disappearance. On the surface, a stranger abduction does seem like the most plausible explanation, as a neighbor remembered seeing Casey alone on the front porch at 9:30 a.m., a short time before her family went looking for her. Since dogs tracked Casey's scent down the street before it came to an abrupt end, this does seem to suggest that she may have wandered off from her home before she was snatched by an opportunistic predator. The one part of her family's story which I did find a bit odd is that the last time any of them recalled actually seeing her is when her mother saw Casey sleeping in her bed at 6:30 a.m., but they did not seem to clue into the fact that she was missing until over 3 hours later. I know that Jonathan thought he heard Casey watching TV in the next room while he was tending to the baby sometime after 9:30. It does seem quite unusual that adults would be able to sleep in that late in a household with a 3-year-old and a 1-year-old. Did they really not see Casey at all during that 3-hour window? It might also seem strange that the family would move from North Delta to Surrey only a few months after Casey disappeared, as you'll often hear stories about parents of missing children keeping the same address and phone number for decades on the off chance that their child ever tried to contact them. But Surrey is only 7 kilometers away from North Delta, so it's not like the family was moving a great distance, and it may have just been too difficult for them to keep living in the same neighborhood where Casey went missing from. Overall, I hardly think this is ample evidence that Casey's family was involved in her disappearance. While you could easily infer that Barbara's suicide may have been motivated by guilt over what happened, she had pretty much hit rock bottom by that point. One child had gone missing, her second child had been removed by social services, and her ex-spouse had just moved to another continent with her remaining child. If Barbara is completely innocent of any wrongdoing, then her entire life was just one big tragedy. Much like with Michael's disappearance, there is so little evidence about what might have happened to Casey, so without anything conclusive, I do not feel comfortable pointing fingers at anyone inside her home, as it's just as likely that she was abducted by an unknown perpetrator. I suppose the best case scenario for both these stories is that Michael and Casey were not abducted by a predator who wanted to do them harm, but by someone who wanted a child to raise as their very own. We've seen numerous examples of cases where infants are kidnapped from their biological parents, and then several years later, they are discovered to be alive and living under a false identity with their abductor. Now, Casey and Michael were 3 and 4 years old, respectively, when they went missing, so the chances of this situation coming to pass are much smaller, but they were still young enough that they conceivably could have been raised by the person who abducted them and have no memories of their life with their real family. Over the past several years, we have had a couple of young adult males who were looked at as possibly being Michael before this was ruled out by DNA testing. One of these young men even admitted that he had virtually no memory of his life before he was 5 years old, which is why he initially could not discount the possibility that he was Michael. Sadly, the most likely explanation is that both these children came to harm by whoever was responsible for their abduction, and neither of them are still with us, but you should never give up hope. So if you happen to have any information about the unsolved disappearance of Michael Dunahy, please contact the Victoria Police Department at 250-995-7654. That's 250-995-7654. Or if you wish, you can also submit a tip through the official website at michaeldunahy.ca. And if you happen to have any information on the disappearance of Casey Bohun, please contact the North Delta Police Department at 604-946-4411. That's 604-946-4411. Anyway, another special thanks to Julie for doing such a great job at narrating our opening. If you've already entered our monthly contest before, you are automatically eligible for my next random drawing, so you don't have to do anything. But if you want to enter, and haven't done so yet, all you have to do is send me an email under the subject line, Trailwind Cold Contest, naming the one unsolved cold case you would most like to see covered on this podcast. So once again, send me an email under the subject line, Trailwind Cold Contest, to robin.warder@icloud.com. That's robin.warder@icloud.com. Another reminder that The Trail Went Cold is on Patreon, so if you have a moment, please visit patreon.com/thetrailwentcold to learn how you can support our podcast and become eligible for some pretty neat rewards. We've released some neat bonus episodes for our donors in Tiers 2 and 3, and this month, we've released the audio from the Canadian Crime Podcast event I appeared at in Toronto back in July, so to learn more information, feel free to visit our Patreon page. We would also like to take a moment to give a shout-out to our most recent listeners who have signed up with us on Patreon, and they are Susanna N., Jason C., Jennifer B., Ethan S., Catherine B., Cynthia O., and Judy B. A big thanks to all of you for your support. I also just wanted to give another shout-out to my supporters at the Unresolved Mysteries subreddit and the Unsolved Mysteries message board at the Sitcoms Online forum. Need to provide a big thanks to Miguel Foote, who edits and assembles this podcast together for me, and Vince Nitro, who composes the eerie music you hear on every episode. If you haven't already, you can like us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter, or leave us a rating or review on iTunes, Stitcher, or Google Play Music. So have yourself a good week and join me next Wednesday for a brand new episode of The Trail Went Cold. Thank you.